From coast to coast to coast, you're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Thasmia Nishat, and I'll be your host for this special archival half hour of environmental news during the holidays. We're going to be talking about those lovely little Festa fellows you've been seeing around lately. But first, let's talk water sustainability. Think about water security and sustainability in Canada, the first name that comes to mind is Maud Barlow. Her book, the third and final in her series focused on water sustainability, is called Blue Future. Here is Terra Informa's Matt Hergy with an interview captured at the beginning of her book tour.
Up to 60% of the human body is comprised of water. The brain is composed of 70% water, and the lungs, nearly 90%. About 83% of our blood is water.
Okay, my name is Maud Barlow, and I'm the National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians, which is a national nonpartisan, nonprofit environmental and social justice movement in Canada.
Well, Maud Barlow says that water is the blood of the earth. And noting the significance of water, Barlow has tirelessly advocated for water sustainability for over 10 years. She has fought to change people's perception around H2O, urging them to think about water as a right and not a commodity. In 2009, she served as senior advisor on water to the 63rd President of the United Nations General Assembly, and was a leader in the campaign to have water recognized as a human right by the United Nations. She is also the author of many reports and several books focused on water sustainability. On October 10th, 2013, Maud Barlow arrived at the University of Alberta to speak about her newest book, Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. I had the opportunity to speak with Barlow about the current realities of water sustainability.
Well, we're in deep trouble as a planet. It depends on where you live, and it's still very hard in Canada to get people to understand the crisis globally. A colleague calls it the reality of modern water, and that is that in the West and in the more urban areas, certainly in a neoliberal capitalist world, we see water as being a resource for our pleasure, profit, and convenience, and we don't see it as the essential element of a living ecosystem. We just have completely divorced ourselves, and water has become a resource for a certain kind of society, a certain kind of industrial development, a certain kind of economic development. So we dump whatever we want in it, and we move it anywhere we want, and we pave over if it suits us, and we, we think we're going to look after one part of an issue like air pollution, by shale gas fracking or biofuels, because who cares about water? So we have this myth of abundance and this notion that water is here to serve us. We see water as a legal entity, that we own water, it's property. And this kind of thinking has led us to displace, pollute, and mismanage the world's water to the point where we really literally are a planet running out of water. And I document that very clearly at the beginning of the book. Demand for water is going straight up and the supply is going straight down, even though we all learned back in grade six that wasn't possible. In fact, it is indeed possible, and it is indeed happening right now.
Your first book in the Blue series was Blue Gold, The Battle Against Corporate Theft, and it was published in 2002. What has changed in the world of water in the last 11 years?
There are some good things. There's much more awareness. I know I talk about politicians not being aware, but I think there's much more general awareness. There are many, many more pieces of research. There are many universities and high schools teaching it. There are many, many, many books. There are many films. There's a consciousness growing around it that was not there when I wrote Blue Gold in 2002. So that's the good. And there's also been a huge network. We call ourselves Water Warriors that have come together here in Canada and around the world to protect local water sources and to stop privatization. Very positive is that the United Nations recognized the human right to water and sanitation, which I was deeply involved in. I thought it would be years before it happened, but just a confluence of things came together, which I describe in the book because it's really exciting. And so the recognition that water, that no one should be doing without water because they can't pay for it, has been formally recognized by us, and I consider that kind of like an evolutionary step forward. On the negative, and I'd say on the positive, I'll stay positive for a minute, that I think we're winning the privatization war around municipal services. I think there's a lot of evidence to show that even the big companies are pulling out, and the government of France has had to rescue Veolia and Suez and put money into shares. So you've got the government bolstering these corporations because they're just not welcome in so many places. On the negative side, I am really worried about the displacement of indigenous people, communities, villages, peasants, and so on around the world for modern water projects. In India, for free trade zones, you know, millions of people being displaced. In China, they're building, they want the rural communities gone. They're pulling people into cities. They have these ghost cities. They've built these cities so fast and so big that they're great big cities that don't have any people in them. And they're just displacing people. The land grabs. There's a land grab, which is also always a water grab, in Africa now. This is three times the size of Great Britain. And this is where private corporations or wealthy countries come in, and they actually buy up the land and the water for profit or to feed their people. And they're displacing the very people who know how to live with drought, who know how to live with cyclical climates, who know how to dry land farm. And what they're doing is they're pulling up, again, aquifer water, and they're building these big chemical-based industrial farms, just the opposite of what we need. So that, if I would say the thing I'm most concerned about, is that I think that when, and I predicted this in both Blue Gold and Blue Covenant, that there would come a time that where governments were making decisions around dwindling water resources to put it to economic development and growth or for people's livelihoods and people's lives. And I'm afraid we're already seeing that that's happened.
In your newest book, which is the final in the trilogy, as the title would suggest, you look to the future of water sustainability. And I guess the philosophical leaps that we'll have to take in order to get to a place where water is again sustainable, what will it take for us to make those philosophical leaps in thinking about water?
Well, people are just going to have to come to grips with the fact that, you know, just like those comet movies in Hollywood, where there's a comet coming at the Earth and all of a sudden nothing really matters because the Earth's going to blow up in 72 hours. We have a comet coming at us. It's called the global water crisis, and it's not here yet in Canada in a visible way, although I would argue it is here in Alberta, and it's certainly here in other parts of the country. But it is here in the world. I mean, China, since 1990, half the rivers in China are gone. Gone. I'm not saying polluted. They were polluted. They're gone. So we need to get our heads around what this means in a world that's going to continue to grow in terms of population till it peaks around 9 or 10 billion. What does this mean? Where are people? How are people going to live? Who's going to be sacrificed in this world? So I guess what I'm hoping people can do is that we can build the kind of movement around this that we built around climate, where people really understand that it's life and death. And this is a climate issue. This is very much, I mean, the way we abuse and displace water is one of the causes of climate crisis. And restoring watersheds is one of the solutions. But I can't make people care. You know, a lot of people just, it's like, you know, when I turn the tap on and the water doesn't come out of my tap, then I'll be upset. But until then, you know, some technology will fix it. Somebody's looking at, the government's looking after it. Somebody's looking after it. And it's, this is the problem with a lot of issues that we're dealing with, is that it's, you know, just a lot of people don't want to know. It's, a friend of mine calls it the right not to know.
The United Nations established that water would be a human right. But I think that is one of the philosophical leaps that we as a society need to take to really, really ingrain that in our collective psyche.
And some places are. I mean, since the United Nations recognized the human rights to water and sanitation, a number of countries have adopted their, or changed their constitution to recognize the human rights to water and have set out a plan, which every country is supposed to do, by the way. Of course, Harper government's not doing, but they're supposed to. So there is real movement taking place. And in the book, I talk about the countries and communities that are really moving this forward. Also, our movement is writing up plans in many different countries. And if their governments aren't moving, they're presenting them to the government saying, you need to do this. Here's what has to happen in our country to fulfill the human right to water and sanitation. Here's the obligations for us here in Canada. It's really on First Nations communities, because that's really where the, with some areas of rural Canada not having proper water as well, but it's mostly on First Nations communities. And so that's where the attention has to go here. Other places, it's much more widespread. It's peri-urban slums and so on. You know, people said, oh, okay, the human right to water and sanitation, you're saying everything will be better the next day. Well, of course not, especially if we're also running out of water at the same time we're trying to do this. But, you know, is it a step forward? Is it a statement of principle and belief that we have collectively in the world? And then what do we do? How do we start to make that real?
Well, talk me through the final point that you make in Blue Future, is that we need to make human laws compatible with nature's laws. Talk me through that argument.
Well, basically, all in Western society, water is a property, and the law, the way the law is interpreted, is that it's a property right. And so, for instance, BP in the Gulf of Mexico, the only people who could sue for compensation were people who could prove that their livelihood had been damaged. Now, you know, forget the fact that the entire ecosystem has been damaged. Nobody can sue for that, and the Gulf can't sue for that. So the concept around the rights of water is that we start, or the rights of nature, or earth rights, there are different terms for it, is that we recognize that water and nature exist outside of their service to us. Yes, it's a big step to see water as a public trust, and then it belongs to all, or, you know, is equally all of ours. But then you have to say it really doesn't belong to us. It really belongs to itself. It serves its own reality. We need to leave water in the ground. We need to leave water where nature put it, because it's serving an incredibly important function where it is. And that is all the ecosystem, all the species that depend on it, the, you know, future ecosystems, future generations depend on keeping those systems as intact as possible. And so it's recognizing that our laws of take, and convert everything to a commodity, and seeing a river and seeing, instead of seeing a flowing river that's all that it's doing for our health and for the environment and keeping us all alive, we see hydroelectricity. So it's turning your head around and asking the question, what is water?
I imagine that would be quite hard to do, though, to take water out of the law, because it's so deeply entrenched in, as you said, sort of how we even think about capitalism in general.
Well, I've used to be much more sophisticated, if you will, when I would speak in the Western states, California, the states that are just Colorado that are in such crisis now. And I'd say, I know your laws are complicated, and there was always the first in time, first in right. And, you know, so you've got all these legal problems, and now I'm not like that anymore. You know what I say? Those laws were meant for a time when you thought there was unlimited water and there were only a few settlers here and you wanted to populate the prairies. For God's sake, that time is gone. You've got to wipe out those laws and start again. And they should do what Vermont has done and name their water, surface and groundwater, to be a public trust, and very clearly say it belongs to the people, it belongs to the ecosystem, they're even going to give priority in times of shortage to local sustainable food production over food production for export. I mean, they're very, very clear that this water must be protected as a public trust for all time. As I say, I used to be sort of more understanding of all the complications. I don't think it's like that anymore. I think we don't have time. We need some very, very clear principles. Water is a human right. Water is a public trust. Water has rights and must be protected. Water can teach us how to live together. Water can become nature's gift to us to teach us how to live differently, to not be a source of conflict, but rather a source of finding ways to deal with other problems, because we have this big one. You know, maybe my father hated your father because whatever, but we're all going to not be able to live on this water system if we don't fix it together. And I've got examples where communities have come together across great divides to protect the local water. Self-preservation, but preservation of my neighbor. And so I, you know, in the end, I'm actually quite hopeful. I consider water to be a moral imperative, or hope to be a moral imperative, and water can be a tool to help us get there.
I have one more question, and it kind of, I guess it relates to self-preservation, because I think when it comes to water today, one of the major things that negatively impacts water management is that little actions compounded sort of have larger consequences because water is so connected. But then it works the other way. Small actions by people in aggregate can have a tremendously positive impact. So I guess my question is, what can I do in my own life to make a difference to water sustainability in the future?
Well, consciousness, just seeing water, remembering that water doesn't just come out of a tap. I think one of the biggest first problems was taps, you know. So we just separated from this body of water that you had to use to go to and get and pull over and heat up and touch. And, you know, now we have all these taps in our homes, and so we just think it comes from somewhere else. So just, you know, reestablish establish a relationship to water and think about it. Don't buy bottled water. You don't need it. I mean, I know there are parts of the world that don't have clean public water, but that's not true here. But then I'd say take it a step further and get involved in the politics of water. You know, if your municipality is looking at privatization, jump in and get involved. Don't be benign. Don't sit back. It's really important that we be part of something.
That was Matt Hergy speaking with Maud Barlow, author of Blue Future. So, we've been seeing those festive fellows everywhere, and they are none other than the Christmas tree. The Christmas tree, as a tradition, has ancient roots, starting with the celebrations of the winter solstice. But now in modern times, we have the dilemma of picking between artificial trees or the old-fashioned living variety. Here's Hamdi Essawi breaking down the pros and cons of each.
For almost 30 years now, my family has used the same artificial Christmas tree to celebrate Christmas. And until recently, I hadn't really thought twice about it. I mean, I knew that there were real-life Christmas trees out there, and people who cut them down or buy them, but it never really occurred to me why we didn't. When I asked my parents why, they said that when they bought ours, there wasn't much room in the budget or apartment for authenticity, even though my mom prefers them. Apparently, her dad used to bring one home every year. And this got me wondering about other people. What makes them choose one tree over the other? So to find out, I hit downtown Edmonton a week before the big day to find out how some shoppers have dealt with this classic Christmas conundrum.
Hi, what's your name?
Renee.
Hi, Renee. Do you have a Christmas tree at home?
Yes, but I don't have it up yet.
What kind of tree do you have? Is it an artificial tree or a real tree?
It's artificial.
And why did you choose artificial?
It was my boyfriend's tree, but I would rather have a real tree.
Oh, okay. So you kind of inherited the tree you have.
Yes.
And why would you prefer a real tree?
It's more environmentally friendly.
Really? How so?
Well, you can replant the trees, and also you waste a lot of material making those artificial trees, I believe.
Something to think about. Thank you very much for your time, Renee. Hi, what's your name?
Jessica.
Jessica, do you have a Christmas tree at home?
No.
How come?
I live in a tiny bachelorette suite, and I go home for Christmas.
Have you ever had a Christmas tree?
Yeah, growing up.
What kind?
A spruce or an evergreen.
So it was a real tree?
Yeah.
And did you prefer the real tree over the artificial?
No, I think it kind of smelled like cat piss.
Fair enough. Nowadays, if you had the space or the time to go out and get a tree, which one would you choose?
Probably a fake tree, just because they're more eco-friendly, and now they have like those special LED lights that twinkle.
Really flashy, huh?
Yeah.
How do you think they're more eco-friendly?
Because you're not constantly buying a new tree every year and chopping them down.
Thanks for your time.
No problem.
What struck me most about these answers were the environmentally friendly claims on both sides of the fence. A real tree is a one-time deal, but unlike a fake, it's biodegradable, recyclable, and it produces oxygen while absorbing greenhouse gas. On the other hand, I've been enjoying my tree for more than 25 years, which means 25 trees are still alive. So then which tree is, well, greener? I was stumped, so I called Dr. Charles Barden for help. He's a professor of forestry and director of the Tuttle Research Center for Kansas State University.
It would be any kind of a pesticide or anything on the tree.
Now, you probably get asked this a lot close to Christmas time, but between real and artificial Christmas trees, which one's better for the environment?
Sure. I would say from an environmental perspective, actually, the real tree is better for the environment.
How so?
The artificial tree that uses a lot of energy and petrochemicals and even lead in their production. And then the artificial tree doesn't, you know, last forever. It really looks good for about, you know, 5 or 8 years. That needs to be discarded and another one purchased.
And which petrochemicals are you referring to specifically?
Well, generally PVC, the polyvinyl chloride, is the primary material that, makes the foliage, basically the plastic foliage of the tree itself.
And unlike fake trees, real ones are actually supposed to help guard against climate change, right? By sequestering or absorbing greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide?
Exactly. During the tree's life, it absorbs a lot of carbon dioxide and puts it into the wood and roots of the tree. And then we harvest that tree, the stump and all the root system is still there, and that slowly adds carbon to the soil. So some of it gets broken down and back to the atmosphere, but much of it will be tied up in the soil.
But when these trees are burned or they decay, they release that stored carbon right back into the atmosphere. So are they really better climate-wise than the alternative?
Right. What it does is if you burn it or get it completely broken down, it does return the carbon back to the atmosphere, but it was the same carbon that it absorbed over the first, 10 years of its life. So we talk about trees being carbon neutral. They, if you, burn up the tree even for, heating your home, it'll be carbon neutral in that you release the carbon that the tree just absorbed over its lifetime. But we aren't taking carbon, fossil fuels out of the ground that's been tied up for millions of years and then kind of adding that to the net global budget of carbon.
Now, I want to ask you about disposal, because real trees don't necessarily have to be thrown out. They can actually be recycled. So how does that work?
A lot of municipalities around the country now will have a certain day when you can leave your trees by the curbside, and they will come through with a separate collector for those and chip them up to use them basically for wood chip mulch in their parks and areas. And also they can be sunken into a pond or lake to be used for fish habitat. They'll act like mini coral reefs with the structure of the branches and needles on the trees will allow algae and plants to grow on them, and small fish will be attracted to that and hiding in the branches, and the bigger fish will come into the shade of the trees that are provided.
That's kind of comforting, actually. So does this mean that the life of a real tree is pretty much finished after Christmas, or is it possible to keep that tree alive and maybe even reuse it?
Yes, that can work, especially in areas where the ground, will not be frozen solid after Christmas. But yes, we call those living Christmas trees, or bald and burlap, or potted Christmas trees. And it does mean you can't really keep it in your house for 3 weeks or so, because the tree will start to lose dormancy and think it's spring and start to grow. And then you put it outside, it'll it'll go into shock and get damaged. But if you want to just keep the tree inside for about a week or so, you also may want to dig the planting hole, you know, when you receive the tree, and then cover it with a burlap or some sheets of cardboard so it doesn't fill in, and then you'll be ready to plant that tree even if there is some frost on the ground when you're ready to take it down after Christmas.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I came across a study on this very topic published by Ellipsos, a consulting firm that specializes in sustainable development. In it, they examined the life cycles of real and artificial Christmas trees in Montreal. According to their results, quote, when compared on an annual basis, the artificial tree, which has a lifespan of 6 years, has 3 times more impact on climate change and resource depletion than the natural tree, unquote. This is due almost entirely to carbon emissions from the production process of those bristly PVC plastic trees. But there's a twist. If an artificial tree is kept for more than 20 years, the table starts to turn. After 20 years, the fuel it takes to truck real trees home begins to tip the scales to the other side, because the carbon emissions from producing and shipping in artificial trees are a one-time thing. I asked Dr. Barden what he thought of this.
The thing that makes me nervous about that is that PVC foliage, the plastic foliage, will start to kind of get brittle and break up. And if they use lead to stabilize that, which a lot of the Chinese manufacturers do, you basically be polluting your indoor air with powdered lead. And so that doesn't sound like a good deal to me. It's always more efficient to ship 1,000 of something than to go get one and bring it back. But when you look at the family memories you're making by visiting a local Christmas tree farm and providing some money to the local economy, and the good memories of the kids picking out the tree and doing that sort of family activity, besides just going to the store and buying one, there's something more important than fuel use in this world, I think.
Thanks, Hamdi Asali, for breaking that down. Before we go, here's this week's edition of What's Happening. On New Year's Eve, Bo Habitat Station in Calgary, Alberta will be hosting A Countdown to Noon, a family-friendly dance party from 11:45 to 12:30 p.m. Activities go from 10 to 4 and include a trip involving feeding the fish, building your own noisemaker, face painting, family photo booth, and more. The cost is $10 for adults, $8 for seniors and students, $6 for those aged 5 to 17, and for those neophytes under 5, they are free. For more information, you can check out bohabitat.alberta.ca. If you missed that, all this information is available on our website, terrainforma.ca. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Our contributors this week were Matt Hergy and Hamdi Asawi. I covered website, Savita got the producing down, and Daniel Dolgoy was our coordinator. Terra Informa is a production of CJSR 88.5 in Edmonton. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, complaints, what have you, send us an email at terra@cgsr.com or tweet it out at Terra Informa. I've been your host, Dasmian Nishat, and I'll catch you next week.